Home again, jiggity jig. Hello again, and welcome back to Big Mouth, where we talk about music, movies, TV, and books, probably a bit more than is healthy. My name's Andrew Harrison, and this week we're looking at Blade Runner 2049. Does Denis Villeneuve's sequel to the classic of film noir sci-fi pass the Voight-Kampff test? And what does it have to say about dystopian science fiction when the real world is going full dystopian even as we speak? Also, we've got our beady eye on Liam Gallagher's first solo album, As You Were, out this weekend. Where now for our kids' raging id? And has he finally found the tunes for The Voice? Plus, we'll be looking at a couple of new releases from the much-vaunted 33 and a Third series of music criticism books and hearing our guests' favourite tunes of the moment. But who are those guests, I hear you ask? Laura Snapes writes for The Guardian, The Observer, Pitchfork, Q, BuzzFeed, and anyone else will have her. She's also a broadcaster who makes documentaries for Radio 4, and she's really into this new podcasting thing with her top 40-themed show, Unbreak My Chart. We're happy to land on the planet of the Snapes. Hello, Laura. Welcome back to Big Mouth. Now, Unbreak My Chart is on, I believe they call it hiatus at the moment, don't they?
It might be politely termed dead, but there's a big archive you can listen to.
Tell us about it. What is the archive of classic material, what's the rationale behind the show?
Well, it was me and a friend of mine, another journalist called Fraser McAlpine, and we had talked for ages about doing a podcast about the charts because they were ignored. It was like a metric that nobody was paying any attention to. And we talked about this for a really long time. And then when it became clear that Ed Sheeran was going to flood the charts with his last album, Divide, we thought, well, this is obviously when we should start doing this. So I think it ran for about 22 weeks, and we covered, there was a lot of Ed Sheeran because he was number one for much of that time, Harry Styles' emergence as a solo star. What was that Scar song, the anti-Theresa May Scar song?
Oh, yeah, we did it on this show, actually, as well. It was called something like Tories Are Bad or something, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, something very nuanced. It was really good fun doing it, but it was just a little bit difficult to pull together.
Doing podcasts is really hard.
There was one particular middle-aged man who got interested in the charts again because of that podcast.
Make that two.
Oh, two of middle-aged men.
Oh, fantastic.
It was target audience you were definitely going for.
Well, you were hearing that middle-aged man just then. Also joining us, Andrew Mayle, contributing to Editors of Mojo Magazine and a writer for The Times and The Guardian, and anybody else will have him. Hello, Andrew. How are you?
Very good, thanks.
Re-engaged with the charts, thanks to
Definitely. Chart.
You just heard him briefly then. Again, it is our producer, the JF Sebastian of podcasts, Matt Hall. Matt, you're our best and only friend. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Now, you haven't seen Blade Runner, so you don't even know what that means, do you?
No, I've not seen Blade Runner 1 or 2, but I have seen last week Nick Cave in Nottingham and had experience of the archetypal don't ever leave a gig before it's firmly over moment. When we got to the end of the main set, my wife was like, that was amazing, but I'm totally wrung out and I need to go outside. You stay for the encore, during which he was in an arena, in Nottingham Arena. He climbed off the stage into the audience and basically came and sang the rest of the Weeping Song, kind of exactly where she was stood on the steps beside her seat.
Oh, so basically,
so I took great delight in showing her, coming out 10 minutes later, and showing her the video of Nick Cave kind of standing where she was standing previously.
So she could have been in the Courtney Cox, Bruce Springsteen role.
She could have been Blixa Bargeld.
Yeah, nice. That's a marriage made in heaven.
Absolutely. Okay, before we get going, a little reminder about our partner show, Remaniacs, the no-bullshit Brexit podcast, co-presented by frequent Big Mouth guest Dorian Linsky, by the way. We've just launched a crowdfunding appeal via Patreon to support Remaniacs and help it grow. We've got 150 backers in just a week, and it is going like the clappers. If you'd like to support Remaniacs in their valuable work of subverting the will of the people, go to patreon.com/remaniacscast and have a look. You can help us develop the show, explore live events and reach more people, and get swanky Remaniacs mugs, T-shirts and other stuff. That's patreon.com/remaniacscast. Okay, Liam and Noel Gallagher, the answer to the question, what would Cain and Abel have done if the NME had been going in biblical times? Since Oasis's acrimonious guitar-smashing split in 2009, Noel has prospered with his high-flying birds outfit, while Liam has endured a stop-start post-Oasis career with the unfortunate BDI. It's fair to say that in both cases, we probably look forward to their interviews more than their records. They are extremely good at being rock stars. But can Liam's first solo record address that? Produced by Greg Kirsten of Adele, Pink and Lily Allen fame, and Dan Gretsch-Margaret, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, he's worked with the Vaccines and the Kooks. It does at least promise a break with the Oasis sound, but oh dear, wouldn't you know it, Bloody Noel is back too, and he's done an album with David Holmes. So how does As You Were stack up? We're going to find out after this. This is Greedy Soul. Greedy Greedy Soul by Liam Gallagher from the new album As You Were. Give him his due. That's not exactly Oasis. It's a bit more chinny chap. Now, Laura Snapes. I'm going to take a wild guess and imagine that you were not exactly looking forward to listening to this record.
I actually was looking forward to it because I think Wall of Glass is good. And I don't know, when I worked at ME, you're so deluged by Oasis that it's very easy to just, you know, declare them the enemies of all good sense and all good art and just decide, like, I'm not having that at all. But it was watching the Supersonic documentary last year that made me think, oh, actually, Mio, maybe I've been unfair. Maybe these guys are brilliant. And so I have, in spite of, you know, some perhaps dodgy opinions that he might hold, I do have a lot of goodwill towards Liam Gallagher.
Yeah.
And I like Wall of Glass and I was curious about what it was going to be like, especially because, you know, he spent so many years banging on about capital R, capital M, real music, that I thought it was almost graceful of him to accept that he's not the world's best songwriter and write with loads of people. There's two songs on the album that don't even have a Liam Gallagher writing credit on. And half of it was made in London with people like Ian Archer, but the other half was made in LA with big pop songwriters, like you say, like Greg Kurstin and Mike Snow. And so I hoped that those people would latch onto his essential, like his great rock star qualities and find a way of presenting them in a brilliant way. But I don't think they've succeeded.
Well, tell me what you thought of it then.
I think it's totally unmemorable. I really like Wall of Glass. I think that's the only song that's kind of got the attitude kind of commensurate to Liam Gallagher's public persona. And I really like Chinatown as well. Mm. It's got that really stupid line at the beginning, maybe you should discuss this on Romaniacs, about
we are going to,
what's
yes.
it mean to be a European, me, I just believe in the sun. That's one of the songs he didn't even write.
It's a fantastic line. What's it mean to be free, man?
Yeah.
What's it mean to be a European? But so stupid, it's brilliant.
Yeah, it's so stupid, it's brilliant. And then this like big, beautiful chorus, which is meaningless and intimate and huge all at once, just comes in and sweeps it all away. And you think, that's kind of what I want from Liam Gallagher record. But the rest of it, his voice sounds shagged. He sounds more like Jake Bugg than Liam Gallagher in parts of it. And also
that's a low blow.
Also, you know, I think it's very much harking back to Be Here Now in the way that it's mixed. Like, if you listen to it in headphones, as I was yesterday, it is so dense with layers. It's got that kind of digital cement mixer churn that the worst parts of Be Here Now had. And it's, you know, there's always brass and choir and piano and guitar in there. Yeah. And it's a bit relentless by the end.
Andrew Mayle, this is a bit more your own, my vintage. What did you make of it?
I was thinking about this, and I was kind of, you know, when you used to look in charity shops and you'd kind of think, why did people need so many Max Bygraves albums back in the day? And you kind of realised that there was a sound that they liked that they found comforting, and they were quite happy to go and buy the same album again. And I was kind of listening to this and thinking, I think this is why people will go and buy this. It doesn't, as Laura was saying, it's not maybe the great departure that you were hoping for. And I kind of found it a bit dull, a bit uninteresting, but the middle-aged man in it found the familiarity of his voice. And you're right, it's not the voice that he used to have. But I found it kind of familiar and comforting. I remember there was a friend of mine, he was in a cab just after that Norton New Order album, Waiting for the Siren's Call to come out, and he was talking to the cabbie, and the cabbie said he was a New Order fan. And he said, oh, what do you think of the new album, Waiting for the Siren's Call? And he thought about it for a bit, and he went, Viable. And I think this is in that sense the Liam Gallagher album is viable, but I don't think it's much more than that. And I find it odd that, you know, essentially kind of Liam and Noel are kind of like the two brothers who were sort of Adidas and Puma. They're sort of fighting over making the same product, you know, and kind of, and I wish there had been more departure, and I wish there was the live, I think his voice really is shot now. I think it's actually quite hard to listen to him live because it's so sort of nasal and grating. But I think the way it's produced on this is interesting. And I kind of wish that because it's set up as a pop product and because it's effects heavy, I kind of wish they'd had more fun with it. The other thing I think as well is I think some of these lyrics are interesting, but the rhymes are bad. In a sense, like, for what it's worth, I think lyrically is a really interesting song, but it's the fact that the rhymes fall in the way that Noel's Oasis lyric rhymes used to fall. So that it becomes quite dull and repetitive because they always fall on the same beat. When you're actually listening to the content of the lyrics, you think, this is pretty interesting for Liam. This is a massive move on. But you have this kind of thudding rhythm to the place in which the rhymes fall, which I find quite weird.
There's also a willingness to replicate Noel's lines that make absolutely no sense whatsoever. When you kind of you're halfway through a song, I think it's the second number, I didn't have the track listing, and you listen to the chorus and just going, What does that actually mean? Yeah. And it doesn't mean anything.
But it's also just, there's a replication.
Oh, is that bold? Yeah. Which is the least bold song. It's like, it's him apologising for misbehaving and being bold, and it sounds neither apologetic nor bold.
Yeah.
But you were looking in vain.
I didn't do as you were told. That, well, you didn't do as I would. It was like, what?
But you will look in vain for meaning in anywhere in the Oasis catalogue. I mean, they're, you know, these are songs that are written just for, like, what line can I fit in after the line I've just written? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I read a really persuasive argument for why that's a good thing by Andrew Smith in Word magazine years ago, who said, you know, if you're looking for meaning here, you're looking in the wrong place. It's not about meaning, it's about feeling. It's basically, it is a choral music of now. It's something for a load of people to sing together. Who cares what it means? It's basically Working Class Cocteau Twins for you there. Well, it doesn't mean anything at all. It's not supposed to.
On the wall of the toilet in the aforementioned Nottingham Arena, when I was kind of taking a comfort break during Nick Cave, there is a there was an ad for Liam Gallagher's tour, and which is very carefully and brilliantly set up so that the dates are around the kind of beginning of December, which you just think, well, that's, it's almost like the album, I mean, this happens quite a lot now, but the album is the calling card to remind people to go and get the tickets for the Christmas gigs where, you know, blokes with who should no longer take their tops off will take their tops off and bellow Don't Look Back in Anger, or one song that Noel sang. But
I think that's I think that's fair enough, and you know, we don't decry people going to the match and going mad, and why should we decry them?
No, I'm not. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but
it's kind of Max Bygraves and Mantovani for you know, the sort of for 2017. It's for middle-aged people who probably don't buy that many records, and the record that they buy, they want to sound, they don't want it to sound different, they want it to sound familiar, and they want it to sound comforting.
Well, I was surprised actually, because I mean, maybe because I'd sort of given Oasis the swerve for so many years, I was actually surprised at how much I genuinely liked and enjoyed this. I think you're right, Laurie, it doesn't really stick with you. I couldn't sing along to a song subsequently, but while it was on, I was kind of quite swept away by the fact that, you know, unlike those last three Oasis albums where you could tell they all hated each other and they were trudging through the movements and you know, grimmer and grimmer, this is a genuine desire to be liked, a genuine desire to sort of like grab hold of you and say, come on, remember the good old days. And you know, Liam is like a big sort of slubbery dog who's jumping all over you, say, let's go to the park, and it's raining outside, Liam, no, let's go to the park. I was kind of quite won over by that. I mean, the elements are exactly what you'd expect. There's all the strings of George Martin, you know, all the rhythms are late period Beatles. There's a little bit of glam rock in there. There's a little bit of chinny chop in there, but not an awful lot. To me, the thing that was impressive was that these bits, this ragbag of stuff that he's had forever, has finally been organised properly by producers who know what they're doing, capital P pop producers. You know, the beats are punchy, the songs are poppy, and, you know, it's full of exactly what you'd expect, you know, sort of, you know, lazy song titles and poor rhymes, as you say. But, you know, I found myself not caring. I found myself just swept along. And perhaps it is. Perhaps I have also fallen victim to that familiarity of, you know, remember when Oasis were great? Yeah. It was a long time ago, but remember when they were great?
I'm not going to compare him to Boris Johnson, but there is
go on.
But that sense in which kind of we know what we expect from him, so kind of any sort of terrible faux pas that he makes, like there's no, that people are tired. You know, people have no interest in being kind of outraged by it. So that sense in which kind of the reuse of kind of Oasis sort of melodies and everything, which is blatant sort of throughout, and it's like, well, of course he'd do that. Why would I get upset about that? You know, and it is like, well, of course it's going to sound like that. Why would that bother me? And it is like, kind of like, there is that just, okay, this is what he does. I'm going to go with it. And I felt that there was a part of me that was doing that while I was listening to it. And then there was the other voice that was going, why are you settling for this? This isn't enough.
Well, yeah, but I mean, nobody expects Liam to be Sun Ra, do they? And the album is called As You Were, although I would love to hear Liam's Sun Ra album. I mean, he said, I think there's something in the quotes that before the album, where he said, you're not going to get a sci-fi jazz odyssey out of me. And I thought, I'd love to hear your sci-fi jazz odyssey.
But there is a kind of feeling that, you know, the thing that's been doing the rounds of the last week, more than any kind of anyone saying listen to any of his songs, is that clip from the BBC documentary about him making a cup of tea. And it is kind of like, you know, if Vic and Bob had done that in their Slade spoof back in the day, everyone would have gone, Vic and Bob, and that's so ludicrous, it's brilliant.
And that is Liam's freeform jazz odyssey. You know, that is him riffing. That is him up there without, you know, a net. And it's hilarious.
That's that quality that I've never been able to understand, why such a man who's so gifted with words cannot translate that into music. Why, when he's working with all these great songwriters, don't they go, you're one of the funniest, quickest, sharpest men in the world. How can we take that and put it in a song?
But I think, you know, sometimes they have, because the opening line in Chinatown, I absolutely love it. is, well, the cops are taking over while everyone's in yoga. Yeah. I thought that's like, that is the kind of thing he'd come out with. And it's funny. And it's also
and you want a bit more of that.
Then. You want a bit more of that.
That's, yeah, but that's one of the ones that's been written by other people. And the thing that I think is really interesting
is that not his line then?
Not at all.
There's no writing credit for him on that song at all.
But hold on, but, if that had been in a Kasabian song, everyone would have gone, oh, for God's sake.
I would have said that's the only bit of Kasabian that I like, that kind of stuff.
But that's the other thing. I'm okay with other people writing material for stand-ups. That's okay. And if that's what they're doing, that's good. And if they're getting the material right, that's absolutely fine.
Yeah. I mean, nobody looks at actors on the telly and goes, no, they don't even write their own stuff. Do some originals, lay off the covers of Shakespeare, you know. I quite enjoyed it. I mean, a lot of it is quite apologetic, but I just think it's quite nice to have him back and capering around in the public sphere.
But why does he need to make an album to do that? Like,
because that's his job. He's a musician.
But it's not really his job. Like, you know, he made two good albums ever, and then he was good for 2 years, and then he spent 20 years being a terrible musician, still kind of like a charismatic frontman. But you know, you mentioned the making the cup of tea thing. When you look at the things that have gone viral for Liam Gallagher, like, he's a man who is made for viral stardom. And when you look at the things that have gone viral over the past year, it's the much softer side of him. It's not the insults anymore. Yeah. It's making tea. It's calling ASAP Rocky, WhatsApp Ricky. It's telling Q magazine, I was running on Hampstead Heath and I thought, that's a nice tree. I'm going to climb that tree. It's almost like what we want from Liam Gallagher isn't the Hellraiser anymore. It's this kind of like weird, beautifully mundane philosopher. And we don't need him to make an album.
You wanted to make being there.
If Facebook got it right, they'd sign him up for a Facebook Live daily broadcast.
I just want him to do interviews forever.
So what are we saying then? Viable?
Viable, yeah.
Just about.
People who like this sort of thing will find that they like it. And I didn't detest it. I mean, I really did quite detest some of those later Oasis albums. It's like, you know, make a decision, do something, for God's sake. You clearly hate each other. It was like it's like putting a glass on the wall while you listen to a disintegrating marriage next door. Kind of horrifyingly interesting. But I just think it's really unfair that Noel has decided to come out with his David Holmes album, which will probably be quite interesting. You know, he'll do crazy things for a change.
It sounds like Tame Impala from what's been out so far.
Well, you know, there are worse things to sound like. Anyway, let's move on. Let's have a violent change of pace. We ask our guests to bring in a tune for the listeners. It can be old, it can be new, anything, providing it sounds nice on the radio. Their own personal editor's recommendation. Laura Snapes, what have you brought in for the class?
I have brought in Rest by Charlotte Gainsbourg, which is the lead single from her new album. So for years, she'd only ever written in English because obviously the shadow of her father meant that there was too much pressure to write in French. But this time, after the sad death of her sister, she decided that she needed to make a very personal album, and she was going to be involved in the lyrics, and she was going to cede less control to her collaborators and write in French. And I think Charlotte Gainsbourg is one of the most underrated musicians. I think that her catalogue, maybe Lemon Incest aside, is solid gold. Like, you know, and you can make the argument that a lot of that is because of her collaborators, but she is such a kind of like captivating, silvery presence at the front of it. And I think this is the most confrontational, strange record she's done. And I thought this single was really beautiful.
Confrontational and strange. Let's have it then. Charlotte Gainsbourg with Rest, as chosen by Laura Snapes. Okay, we're going to talk about Blade Runner 2049. How do you make a sequel to a movie that was pretty much perfect and self-contained? And when Ridley Scott's original created a world so plausible and powerful that vast tracts of the science fiction that came afterwards basically followed its look and feel. Most importantly, how do you not create a repetitive box-ticking Trainspotters mess like Scott's Alien prequels? One thing you can do is hire a new director, in this case Denis Villeneuve, director of Arrival and Sicario. As for the rest, we'll see after taste of Blade Runner 2049.
Thought you might be able to help me with the case. Any idea where I could find him?
Your police plan on taking me in.
I would much prefer that to the alternative.
Every leap of civilization was built off the back of slaves. Replicants are the future, but I can only make so many. I had the lock, and he has the key. I think I found him.
That's not possible. If this gets out, We've bought ourselves a war.
You're a cop. I had your job once.
Things were simpler then.
What do you want?
I want to ask you some questions. What happened?
I covered my tracks. Scrambled the records.
We were being hunted.
By who?
All these things have evidently not been lost like tears in the rain. Blade Runner 2049, though, the a cappella version, a sequel 35 years after the original. Unfortunately, Laura Snapes couldn't make it to see the screening, so we were not able to get a 100% clean and unsullied mind on this film. But we do have Andrew Mayle and also Michael Moran, our Geek Desk correspondent.
Definitely an unsullied mind.
Yeah, man about the internet who has dropped in specially. Hello, Michael, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks for asking.
Jolly good. Are you still sort of deconstructing Blade Runner in your mind and getting over it?
I'm wallowing in it.
Excellent. Well, let's wallow right now. Andrew Mayle, firstly, is there unfinished in the business in this movie that needed to be addressed? Did it need to be made, do you think?
Did it need to be addressed is an interesting question, because one of the pleasures of Blade Runner, I think, is that it doesn't wrap everything up. I think that's one of the reasons why it's lasted, that people have returned to it and that people still think about it, because not everything is tied up in a neat bow. So, that's entirely up to the person coming to this film to think, do I want some of the unanswered questions and that answered? But if you do want some of those unanswered aspects of the film addressed, yes, it does approach them.
It's almost impossible to discuss this film without destroying it. There are exciting twists almost in the first 5 minutes, aren't there? So, Michael, your task is set up Blade Runner 2049 without any spoilers of any kind. Go.
This is like a Radio 4 game show.
Mornington Crescent.
In Blade Runner 2049, we skip a little ahead from the original action of the film. There is another Blade Runner, mm-hmm. who apparently there are still replicants to be tidied up and dealt with. And we meet him in his workaday, meeting replicants and retiring them. And that's about as far as I can go without breaking everything, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Because you're dumb. The great thing about it is it's Philip K. Dick's world of the workaday, isn't it?
Yes.
It's a working stiff getting through his stuff and discovering that there is something deeper and more frightening beneath his stuff, as exactly as happened to Rick Deckard in the original Blade Runner. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that the date is significant, because dates appear in it.
Absolutely.
Small dried fruit?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Well, there are three small films that you can watch on YouTube in preparation for this as well are each set at kind of dates in between the first Blade Runner and this one that kind of prepare you for certain elements within the film.
Do you like the ethics of that?
I think it doesn't. I've watched them, and you don't need to watch them to enjoy the film.
But it's kind of that you have to do homework.
No, they're like little teaser trailers. You know, yeah.
Did we enjoy it
broadly?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't tell you. I appreciate this won't be everyone's contention, but I actually think it's slightly better than the original film.
I think it's the things about it that are better than the original film. I absolutely loved it. I found it totally overwhelming, utterly thrilling, and I felt I'd been dumped not just back into the Blade Runner world, but into the expanded, the things going on beyond the fringes of Rick Deckard's world. Andrew, what did you think about it?
There were lots of things about it that I thought were absolutely amazing, and it's difficult because you're approaching this film from the very few reviews that have been have basically said 5 stars masterpiece. Yeah. And so you're coming into a film expecting, well, I would expect something flawless from that. I don't think it's flawless. Visually, as a piece of design and kind of the look of it, I think it is a masterpiece. I think one of the amazing things about it is that it feels like you are entering a coherent visual world. I think there are faults with the film, but I think those are faults in terms of kind of its depiction of certain female characters.
Yeah.
And I think there are plot faults in there. But in terms of its visual design and in terms of the world in which these characters exist, I think it's flawless.
I think it's important that to discuss the portrayal of women in this film. We've got 4 white blokes. Michael, I know you had your issues. You mentioned
I was profoundly troubled by that. I must say, I don't.
Well, tell us why. Tell us exactly. I mean, if you can do it without spoiling,
I'll do my best. The gender politics of this film are, in my mind, not the gender politics of 2017, nor are they the gender politics where I rather fancy will be prevalent in 2049. They're very much true to the original film, in the same way that in the original film, one of the 4 replicants that are principal in the film, one's a basic pleasure model, we're told, and the other one is working as an exotic dancer and gets shot in a transparent raincoat.
Hmm.
It's about that level.
Yeah.
Mm. We are shown that one character is a bad character by him doing something absolutely dreadful to a defenseless woman for no reason that I can gather. It does not advance the plot. It's just nasty.
Okay. Andrew, what's your take on this? Because you actually ran it past an actual woman, didn't you? You actually spoke to an actual woman about it.
The defence of that might be someone might come and say, well, that's the politics of that world in the future. But I think there's one key scene where you actually think, well, no, this is the male gaze of the director. There's a scene in which, and I don't want to give anything away, but in which a character that Kay, the Ryan Gosling, you know, the Blade Runner, is associated with, and she brings another woman back to the flat. And there's a scene that is basically purely about the objectification of those two women. And you could argue that it's about showing off the technology and the design, but it goes on forever. Yeah. And I found it really uncomfortable because I'm thinking, I meant to find this pleasurable. I'm not finding it pleasurable because I know women watching this would just think, this is really uncomfortable and really unpleasant. I don't think that you can look at that and think that's the politics of this future world. That is the eye of the camera and the eye of the director finding pleasure in that scene.
I'm going to disagree with that because I think that is both the politics of that future world and it is the theme of Blade Runner. The theme of Blade Runner is people as objects. Mm. We make people for our own pleasure. They're disposable, they're throwaway. And of course, the dialogue between that in the first movie and even more in this movie is, well, are you real? If you can treat a fully functioning biological creature as a disposable object, well, you're a fully functioning biological creature. Aren't you disposable? It is an utterly commodified world. That's why it's full of commercials. That's why you can't go anywhere without a holographic dancing girl cavorting in front of you. Well, it is epically sexist. That's the world.
Wasn't two male figures cavorting in the same way?
Yeah, there are no male prostitutes.
There isn't a six-story high naked man at any point. Presumably, I mean, this is a practically deserted world. We see far fewer actual individuals than we see in the original 82 Blade Runner. Hmm. It's practically deserted. Virtually no one's there. Yet there are sex workers catering to I don't know what trade because we don't see any other people.
And the streets are pretty crowded. The people living at the bottom of the city, in Megacity One terms, they're pretty crowded. There's a lot of hustling and bustling and outdoor food markets, which, by the way, interestingly, 1982 displayed as awful and dreadful. When seen in 2017, hey, great, that's Shoreditch. I'll go there right now for my dirty burger.
It's full of pop-up food stalls.
Absolutely,
It's a food court, isn't it?
It is a food court.
It's a food court.
Yeah. So it's weird. You're right, though. Parts of this world are incredibly crowded and parts of it are utterly deserted. My feeling about that is, why is it not displaying male sex workers? Why is it not displaying a lot of things? It can't show everything about this world. What we see is farming, which is pretty grim. We see urban life, which seems to be primarily based around sex work and violence.
And we see fruity young ladies in the nip.
And we see the corporate heights. There's loads of things we don't see. We don't see education. The film can't be about everything. We do see an element of how things are made in this world, and it's ugly. You know, you don't want to see how the sausages are made. It's an ugly way that things are made. I mean, the fact that those scenes are uncomfortable, and they are really uncomfortable, I think they're completely of a piece.
I disagree because I think that the scene I keep coming back to, which I can't really go into detail about, I genuinely think that is not filmed from a position in which we're meant to feel kind of that this is ooky. It's filmed in a very, quote unquote, saucy way. I had a problem.
Has Vaseline been applied to lens?
No, not to the lens.
Everything's in super, super sharp. Yeah.
Frankly, applying a Vaseline to lens might have helped.
What do we make of Ryan Gosling in the central role? Because I don't think it's a giveaway to say that you're not going to get 3 hours of white hot Harrison Ford action here, are you?
You are not.
I thought Ryan Gosling was brilliant. I think that sense, one of the things that clearly the first film was about and this film is about is that movement between kind of the real and the non-real. What is it to be human? What is it to be non-human? And he has this ability. I mean, obviously he has it in previous films, this sense of kind of being somewhat removed from the world of the real. And therefore he's perfectly cast in this because there is that constant flicker which kind of makes you think, like people did after they saw the first Blade Runner, the whole thing was like, is Deckard a replicant? Mm. Well, before that question is even asked of Kay in this film, his performance suggests a movement between the real and the unreal. Yeah. I thought, A, it's brilliant casting, but also I think it's an absolutely brilliant performance.
Surely the question now would be to go back to his previous films and say, actually, was he playing a replicant in Drive?
Definitely.
Well, yeah. Clearly in... is it Only God Forgives? Is that what it's called? Or kind of Be the Place Beyond the Pines and things that. You can see part of that performance there. And I think it's key... I'm glad you brought that up because it sounds to anyone listening to this that we're just griping about this film. And I don't, you know, we clearly aren't. There are areas of it that I think are absolutely genius. And I think as a piece of design visually, it's just awe inspiring. And I think Harrison Ford is terrific in it. And I think Ryan Gosling is terrific in it. I have lots of problems with it, but they are not.
Does Harrison play Indy's dad?
He gets into a fridge.
That's given away too much.
No, yeah. Special effects have moved on so much. He actually plays Indy's motorbike riding annoying son.
Yeah. One of the things that, I mean, it's the themes of Blade Runner are, yes, what is real, but they're also what is memory. That's part of it. And you know, oh, your memory's real. And what I really loved about this, it's clearly made with an awful lot of love and an awful lot of attention. Actually, co-written by the writer of the original Blade Runner as well. And there are so many immensely subtle callbacks to things. Things like the origami unicorn and even that great scene in the original where there's a bubbling pot in J.F. Sebastian's flat and for some reason it's utterly terrifying. There's a bubbling pot that you see very, very early and it's utterly terrifying. You never quite know why. Beautiful kind of subtle little connections that you don't actually need to have seen, I don't think, the original to get those bits.
The other thing that it reminded me of, and I think there's definitely parallels with that, is Twin Peaks: The Return, because you know they are also things about kind of what it means to be free from a narrative imposed on you. Also that crossover with sort of memory and aging and also characters' relationships with kind of an old story told about them. And, you know, it's kind of... And when it was at its best, I really did think, oh, this is as good as Twin Peaks: The Return in terms of how it addresses all those ideas.
The first half of the film, I thought, was ravishing, really enjoyable. Yeah. And the sigh and the fire were more clearly hooked together than they were in the original. It made more, you know, the sigh made more sense with the fire.
Yeah.
But then something happened. And then after that, I found myself looking for more examples of that thing.
I think this is the best movie I've seen this year. I absolutely loved it. And I'm totally going to go back and see it.
I would agree with that. I do think it is. And I, you know, I don't want to sound like, you know, Mr. Right On. But I found it problematic with its attitudes to women.
Do you think we're going to be getting, as we did with the original Blade Runner, loads of different cuts? The director's more sensitive. The woke cut. Blade Runner 2049 brackets the woke cut is coming with all the bad bits taken
but
out.
The thing is, I think it would work perfectly well with that. I mean, you know, the pivotal scene that really gave me a bad squick and then made me start looking for the rest of it could go. I don't think it would hurt the story one iota.
Yeah, for me, best movie I've seen this year. Even better than Mother. Better than Mother.
Blade Runner 2049 there. We've seen things you people wouldn't believe. But enough of them. Time for some more music. Andrew Mayle, what have you brought in?
Oh, I have brought in the new track by The Breeders called Wait in the Car. It's the first material from the original lineup of Kim and Kelly Deal and Josephine Wiggs and Jim McPherson since 1993's Last Splash.
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten how much I'd missed them and how much I kind of missed that sense of kind of just excitement, playfulness, brevity. It's just over 2 minutes long, and they pack in loads of weird changes and odd call outs of lyrics. And I found it incredibly thrilling and exciting, and it was over far too quickly.
Fantastic. Well, Deal or No Deal, let's have a listen. This is The Breeders, and Wait in the Car. The greet us with Wait in the Car, as chosen by Andrew Mayle. Now, you may know the 33 and a third series of books already, a series of pocket-sized novella-length explorations of classic albums. Billed as short books about music, they present a very particular kind of long-form music criticism, a good long read about a single album. The two latest editions out this week cover Björk's Homogenic from 1997 and the debut album by The Raincoats from 1979. We're going to talk about them and the 33 and a third series in general after this from Homogenic. This is Björk and Yoga. Or is it Yoga? Yoga.
All these accidents that happen follow the dot. Coincidence makes sense only with emergency. How beautiful to be.
The cops are taking over while we're listening to Yoga. That was Björk. And a track from Homogenic, subject of a new 33 and a third book by Guardian and former Enemy writer Emily Mackay. These are two books which dig into the making and context of these two records, Homogenic and The Raincoats' debut. Laura Snapes, I believe you have to declare an interest here in a connection with these two.
I am good friends with both of these writers. Emily Mackay was my first real boss, and yeah. Jen is a friend from Pitchfork.
So what did you now, with that in mind, tell us what you thought about there. Let's do Björk
first. Prepare to destroy your friendship.
Yeah. Let's start with Björk. I know this record inside out, and I found it really, really interesting. There's an awful lot of stuff here that I had no idea about. You know, it can go into the depth that a standard feature can't.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to say that of the two records, Homogenic was the one that I knew least about. I know bits of Björk's catalogue, but not all the way through. And, you know, sometimes these 33 and a third books can be really patchy, but I love the way that Emily dealt with it. You know, it's probably quite straightforward to be like, you know, history and production and significance, but I just felt that she dug into it in a very interesting way, and you really got Björk's perspective. You got the impression that she wanted to create something that hadn't been there before to reflect her own experiences, as Björk this is, with this record. And I think that's, you know, bringing it back to The Raincoats as well. Both of these books are about female artists who look around and they do not see any sound that reflects them, so they invent it. And I think that spirit of invention is present in both these books.
What I thought was really interesting about the Homogenic one in particular is that she kind of wanted to get away from her pop London self, where she'd been making basically loads of house records and being a, you know, being a pop star, and become more Icelandic. But she ends up in Spain and she makes a record which I had never realised is fully Spanish flavoured.
Yeah.
You know, I'd always listened to this and thought, you know, volcanoes and lava and ice flows. And then actually it's full of, you know, flamenco and, you know, kind of that sort of, you know, deep Iberian drama.
Yeah, totally. And she makes a really interesting point in it that Icelandic people, so Björk in one of the quotes says, like, Icelandic people got annoyed that she went to make an Icelandic record in Spain. But I think this is where the album, from reading Emily's book, what I came to understand was that this is the record where Björk decides that home is wherever you make it. Like, she is capable of inventing, to sound immensely pretentious, like, psychological territories that don't necessarily have to be the place that you are singing about, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Andrew, am I right in thinking you hadn't really listened to Homogenic at all before this?
I'd never heard Homogenic before.
How did you manage to miss it? It was massive around that particular time.
Because I've always had a problem with Björk. Yeah. It's not an aesthetic problem. It is purely kind of an aural sort of problem. It is like there's something in the sound of her voice and her phrasing that I've never wanted. I've never chosen to listen to. Out of pleasure, I've never gone to that place, and I don't. You know, it's like you can dislike something and that not fault the genius of it, and not fault the kind of the creativity of it. You know, which I think sometimes a lot of people sort of overlook. You can go, kind of, I fully accept, you know, what you're saying about this artist, but I'm still not going to go there.
I just don't like it. Yes.
Yeah.
No, listen to it again in the context of this book. What did you?
It's interesting because. I think I need, before I continue, I think I need to say something, an issue and a problem that I have with 33 and a third books. And I think that seems to be, and I'd like to know where it comes from, whether it comes from the commissioning editors or whether it's kind of the expectation of what a 33 and a third book should be. But there seems to be this need to present the work in the style of academic writing, and I sometimes find that it's a death blow for the writers and the album. And I wonder, is it a fault of the format? Is it a fault of the brief? But there's this because there's I think you know, I think Jen and Emily are two fantastic writers. Jen wrote actually two of my favourite reviews this year, the pieces on Alice Coltrane and Julie Byrne that she did for Pitchfork. And there's a piece that Emily writes on the 33 and a Third website, which I found far more enjoyable and persuasive, which is actually the thing that made me go and listen to this album than the book she wrote, where there is a sense of which she embraces these ideas of pleasure and consumption and her own self as audience and the distance of time and all these things that you are actually involved in and concerned in as a listener to music. And then kind of you are reading this book and you suddenly get into this kind of, you know, peer-reviewed academic style where it's like, in order to explore homogenics' unique position in Björk's timeline, I intend to, you know, kind of in the third chapter, I will look at the way there is no reason to write like this unless your editors are saying it or unless there is this sense that you need to impose a respectability on writing about music that you feel isn't there. Yeah. And that you look at other stuff that both writers have done, they are better than the style that the 33 and a Third books seem to me, a person outside of that world and not knowing, seems to impose on them.
I've never read any 33 and a Third books before. And the one that, out of these two that I really enjoyed, because I knew the record less, was The Raincoats.
Yeah.
And I think the problem with the Björk one, and looking through the list at the back of the books that are all the other records, they are very much kind of from the canon, but they all very much kind of, you know, there's one that I could, two if you count Aretha Franklin, but there's one pop album in all the books that 33 and a Third have put out. There's a New Kids on the Block out. Well, yeah, but, you know, it's definitely they're going more for the kind of, dare one say it, the kind of Mojo approved.
I would disagree. I think
the problem with that is that the records that you know, I find I'm less interested in finding out more about. Whereas the Raincoats record, which I hadn't listened to, I'd listened to occasionally, but not very often, I've become kind of obsessed with.
So the Raincoats is the one that you love the most, Laura, because you have a pre-existing relationship with this record and presumably out before.
Well, no, not so much really. Like, I have a pre-existing relationship with Jen, I had seen the Raincoats once at ATP, and I was probably very hungover and about 20 and just thought, who are these shrieky women? I'm not interested. But because I knew Jen was writing this book and she kept talking about them, I thought, oh, I should revisit this. And now I've come to really, really love that record. So
I thought it was, I really enjoyed this book because it made me go back. And I remember when I was a kid at school and I was about sort of 12 or 13, and my best mate's elder sister had records by the Raincoats and Kleenex and the Modettes. And I can remember listening to those records and the kind of excitement of it. And this has made me go back and listen to those things. And it's just so much, so joyful, I think, and brilliant. It's been a really good, I've really enjoyed, it's been a great experience.
And on that bombshell from leading feminist Matt Hall, we're going to come to the end of the show, which means it's time for Closing Time Chatter, where our guests talk about what's captured their attention this week. Laura Snapes, what has captured your attention this week?
I was very intrigued by the saga of Claire Balding's interview with Saga magazine, which I think at the weekend, I'm not sure if it was in The Observer or just on The Guardian's website.
No, it was in The Observer.
It was in The Observer. The person who had been sent to profile Claire Balding for Saga magazine published what seemed at the time to be a very exciting takedown of the kind of celebrity profile industrial complex, claiming that Claire Balding had demanded, you know, copy approval, and that the copy had been sent to her publicist and they had said, this is too gay and we need some more adjectives about how lovely she is in there. And when you read the story as told that way, you think, wow, the writer was right to be very angry about this. Although it's one of those things where you can look at it and go, this is terrible, why are things like this? But it's the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the way that celebrity profiles are set up and kind of like the bargaining inherent in them. So that was interesting on Sunday, but Claire Balding has now since come out saying that I've had to bite my tongue for a few days, but none of this is true and I don't really know what's happened. I just thought in the way that celebrity profiling works, and I just thought it was very intriguing.
Well, it's irrespective of what actually happened in that case and, you know, declared interest. I write for Saga and I think that is a really good editor none of this struck me. It struck me that there's an awful lot more to this story. Well, I think we can all agree that letting celebrities approve the copy is a uniformly bad thing.
Yeah. I think there's also a thing that the kind of the OBS and the Guardian website need to kind of take a look at, because the headline on the online version of this story is markedly different and much more clickbaity than the headline in the paper.
The headline on the site version is Claire Balding stole my byline.
Yeah.
And that's not... And that's nobody's alleging that. Andrew, I know that you know Mojo have never done this, and certainly I've never done it where I've worked. And Laura, she can't imagine
you. Absolutely not.
No, yeah, it's just like you're quickly handed over the keys.
There was a question online, it's like, you know, and who has been asked to do this? And it's like, well, you know, people are going to push their luck and ask you to do it. And all you do is you just delay and delay and delay. Of course, you know, it's like, oh, it's got it, you know, and then it's like, oh, it's gone to press. You know, it's like kind of, unless you sign something, you know, kind of, and then kind of, even then it's like, oh, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to sign that.
I was once asked
But I have been asked and I've just fudged it.
Come on, who? You know, spill the beans. I'm going to spill the beans. I was asked, not by the Spice Girls PR, but by Mel B. You should let us see the copy. You should let us rewrite so that we can fix the mistakes. And I said, I'm not going to do that, Mel B. She didn't seem to be unduly annoyed about that.
Looking for extra work as a sub.
Yeah,
I have to say one profile this week where I wish that the it had been sent back to the subject to correct was, did you read the Kate McKinnon Vanity Fair cover story?
Send it back to Kate McKinnon and say, can you please put something about Kate McKinnon in this?
Can you put some quotes in here? Because yeah, I think I forgot to turn on my tape recorder. What happened?
I know, yeah.
I think that's exactly what happened, because that's what happened with Douglas Coupland when he went to interview Morrissey. So he wrote a discursive piece on the art of the interview. That's what people do when they forget to turn the tape recorder on.
Why can't they say, sorry, Kate McKinnon, forgot to turn the tape recorder on. Can we just get half an hour's lunch again? Here's five questions.
Absolutely. P.S. This is Vanity Fair.
Yeah, exactly.
We might even pick up the tab. Let's go somewhere nice.
Is doing the cover photos.
Absolutely. Andrew Mayle, what's your closing time chatter?
It's a piece by, I think it's pronounced Joe Zaday. He writes for Vice and The Guardian. And it's about a journey to Llandwy Brefi in mid-Wales to find a buried batch of the strongest acid ever made that was hidden during Operation Julie. And the great thing about
Operation Julie?
It was big drugs bust.
Yeah.
That went in. And I think isn't the Clash's working, Julie's been working for the drug squad about that.
Absolutely. And Llandwy Brefi was this centre for kind of beatniks and heads and acid dealers in the 60s and 70s. And so he's talking to this photographer about this story in the pub, and the photographer says, let's go there now. And he says, oh, no, the story's been done. It's been told. And they go anywhere. And the great thing about it is, because there's a Guy Talese line about, you know, no story is ever dead. And so he revisits it, and he actually finds the guy who was at the centre of it all, who nobody, this guy, old hippie called Smiles, who's now in his early 70s, covered in tattoos, long white hair. And no one's ever been interviewed about him. And he was at the centre of Operation Julie. And just because he gets on with the locals in the pub, they sort of tell him where he lives. And it's a beautifully written piece, but it's also that kind of, you know, proof that you can go back to a story, and because you're a different person or the times have changed, you can tell it from a different angle and offer of something new and fresh. Well, and I just thought, you know, I mean, Vice still gets a lot of knocks for a lot of the things that it does, but the freedom that it gave him to write that piece, I just thought it's just a glorious piece of writing.
Well, I'll try and remember to stick it up on the Facebook page, but if you want to Google it, the headline is A Fateful Hunt for a Buried Stash of the Greatest LSD Ever Made. And whatever else to talk about, that's a headline.
That's clickbait.
That's a clickbait.
Should we just finish now and go and try and find it?
Absolutely. Matt, what's your closing time chatter?
So a month ago, I was railing on Twitter about how the BBC doesn't pay any attention, constantly goes over the kind of story of pirate radio from the 60s and pays absolutely no attention to the much more exciting pirate radio from the 80s, black pirate radio in London. Lo and behold, a documentary appears on BBC 4 last week, a really brilliant documentary on pirate radio from London in the 80s, featuring all the kind of main players, the guys who set up KISS and LWR, and the story of kind of how KISS went legal, and people like Trevor Nelson and Giles Peterson. And so it's just, if anyone wants a documentary to be made on BBC 4, just give me the nod and I'll rail about it on social media, and somebody apparently is listening.
So BBC 4 are basically doing requests?
Yeah.
Okay, fantastic. Well, yay the BBC, but mine is boo the BBC, because I'm disgusted and furious. I'm a disgusted licence fee payer to discover that the Desert Island Discs search function seems to have been removed from the Desert Island Discs website. Now, this is worse than it sounds, because you used to be able to go and just put in the name of any band or any composer, and it would tell you who had chosen them over the years. It would tell you, you know, who's chosen the Human League, who's chosen Dvorak, all these things.
How many sports people have chosen Sisters are doing it for themselves?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, how many business leaders have chosen Simply the Best? And it's, you know, answer all of them. And it seems to have gone, and they've redesigned the website, and it looks like another one of these bloody annoying things where something lovely and useful and clever and particular to one specific show has been removed because it's not consistent with the Gardener's Question Time site, or the typeface is not our corporate brand for customer facing going forward. It's like this lovely thing has disappeared. Someone will now doubtless tweet us and say it's on a different page, here's the URL, in which case, great, brilliant.
It's a new recipe scandal.
It is the new recipe scandal. So there we go, another show boiled in the bag. Thanks to Laura Snapes and Andrew Mayle for joining us. Please come again. Thank you, Snapes, for fighting your way through the terrible cold. You've done
tried not to sniff in the mic, sorry.
I think you did a marvellous job. Thanks also to Michael Moran for coming in and having watched Blade Runner 2049 for us. A major burden to him, I'm sure you can imagine. Remember, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again and all of our past shows at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. You can also subscribe to us via Apple Podcasts using the app on your phone or other device. And you can hear us on Spotify too if you don't have an iPhone. We'll be back again next week. Have a good one. Bye-bye.